Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. We're choking on the smoke from the wildfires north of us here, but it pales in comparison to the devastation facing the people in Sonoma, Mendocino, and Napa counties. I hope you'll hold them in your thoughts and prayers if you're a prayerful person. But we're going to cut through the haze here and address our opening story today to Rachel Maddow, because I took notes after watching her broadcast last night. And it's time once again to call her out for media malpractice. Not journalism, not honest reporting, but selling us a telenovela with a new installment every night about Trump and Russia. And it has come so far from any foundation of fact and provable public evidence that I find it infuriating to watch her spin this up on a nightly basis. So last night, after doing a good job about 3 minutes of reporting on the devastating wildfires here in my backyard, Rachel, of course, turned to Russia, and more about Russia. And I'm going to play a clip from her program and talk back to it a little bit. I hope not to annoy you too terribly much, but it is infuriating to hear her as she substitutes speculation for fact, and she cobbles together multiple sources in the corporate media reporting on the same story to try to show that she's not the only one out there who is promoting these unproven narratives. So she opens with a catchy video, these rappers Williams and Calvin, and they claim to be from Atlanta, and they've got a BLM, Black Lives Matter, insignia behind them, and they deliver a spiel about how Hillary is evil and they're going to vote for Trump. And she says that Facebook pulled it in August because it was being promoted by a Russian-backed account. Then she says, in a quizzical way, they referenced the Clinton Cash movie that Steve Bannon had produced, and while that was a partisan piece of propaganda, just like what Rachel Maddow is doing these days, there were elements of truth to it. The Clinton Cash was an expose on the Clinton Foundation. And then, once again, in the speculative mode, asking a question, she says, maybe they live in Nigeria and were being paid by Russia. She does not attempt to prove that assertion in any way. She just floats it as a, well, maybe they are. And then she said something made Facebook and Twitter shut them down for being bought and paid for by Russia. Again, that is not proven. It is just stated. Then she says that Facebook issued a statement in April that she now has the original version of, and the published version deleted references to Russia. We don't know why, she says. But Russia has been buying ads to influence our election. And then she says, as we join the clip here, that there has been a month of really good reporting on this.
Russia using their platform to try to affect the election. Had they told us about that 6 months ago when they apparently knew it, maybe all this reporting that we're getting now would be 6 months further along. But for whatever reason, Facebook decided they wouldn't admit anything about Russia using their platform until September. And so we have had this long delay in terms of, as a country, coming to any understanding about what Russia was really doing to try to influence our election.
And what Rachel doesn't even allow is, as a possibility, is that it took this long for Facebook to scour millions of files, servers all around the world, to come up with the information. I don't know that for a fact, but she is impugning Facebook and inferring motives that are not in evidence. And this becomes part of the overarching narrative as she goes on to say that all these other outlets have joined her in good reporting about the evil influence of Russia in our election.
It was active on their platform buying ads as of early September. Since then, we have had a month of really good reporting that has finally opened the floodgates so that we regular people, you know, not congressional investigators, not Mueller's prosecutors, not people who work inside these tech companies, but regular Americans can, through the virtues of good journalism, now see what exactly Russia did.
Now, this is not good journalism, and we are not able to see exactly what Russia did, because all we have is evidence that there were some accounts linked to Russian people. We don't know which Russians were involved. The immediate speculation is that these are people loyal to Putin who are carrying out his orders. Again, there is no evidence to support this, and it might be true, but at this point, I have to deal with the evidence that is before us. The other thing that's fascinating is she doesn't put any context around this. The amount of money spent by these alleged Russian accounts on Facebook totals about $100,000. We know that 55% of that was spent after the election, including one piece that is shown on the screen, as I'll identify here shortly, that is inconvenient for Rachel because it refers to the president-elect. And this shows, this is my indictment of her reporting. She wants to call it journalism, and I call it movement media, because it promotes a specific agenda and a foregone conclusion that Russia attempted to manipulate our election. And I want you to listen carefully to her as she will rotate between just talking about Russians in general and talking about Russian agents. Now, an agent, that term can be very loosely applied. I could be considered an agent for Russia because I don't believe what Rachel Maddow is promoting. And a low-level hacker at some internet firm, whether it's in Nigeria or New Orleans or St. Petersburg, is that a Russian agent? And one more thing before we go back to the videotape here. Rachel Maddow makes absolutely zero mention of the remarkable interview on 60 Minutes the night before with Brad Parscale. He was the digital director for Trump. He denies any collusion with Russia, and you may not find that credible, but a good journalist would reference this. And he, of course, was in charge of an $85 million budget, the bulk of which was spent on Facebook. He showed the various types of ads. He said he produced as many as 50,000 to 100,000 variations on Facebook posts and Facebook ads on a daily basis. And so Rachel Maddow is going to trot out some examples of the Facebook ads linked to so-called Russian agents and so-called Russian accounts. And these are just a handful. We have no information on how they were distributed and exactly how many people saw them, much less who shared them or endorsed them on the Facebook platform. All right, back to Rachel.
All right, Daily Beast was first, less than a week after Facebook had its initial admission in early September. Daily Beast found this group, Secured Borders, which purports to be an American group. It is not an American group. It was operated by Russian agents. Daily Beast had the first report on them back
Prove
on
it.
September 11th, that this was one of these fake identity, Russian-run Prove Facebook
it.
Groups that appeared to be American, but it wasn't. And what it was trying to do online during the election was gin up fear of immigrants.
Prove it.
That Secured Border group tried to get Americans to go hold anti-immigrant and anti-Hillary Clinton rallies in places like Idaho.
And in fact, they attempted to, whoever ran these pages did attempt to get people to come to these rallies, and there's no evidence that a single one of them caused more than two people to show up. Rachel doesn't mention that.
Then 2 days later was reporting from Business Insider, who turned up another fake Facebook entity secretly run out of Russia. This one was called Heart of Texas.
Prove it.
Not operated from Texas. It's operated from Russia.
Prove it.
And some of that is evident in their hilarious effort to sound Texan or even to sound vaguely English speaking. This one's great and memorable.
Now, as you hear this, understand that from anywhere in the world, the only people who use mangled English, who can't construct an idiomatically correct phrase in English, are Russians. It couldn't be anybody else, including an illiterate American who supports Trump. Bad English means Russia.
In love with Texas shape. Close. You guys are close, but not quite there. And this Heart of Texas group was an I Love Texas group and a pro-Texas secession group. But mostly they appear to have been anti-Hillary Clinton. Some of it idiomatically correct and some of it not. This one, I don't even know what it means literally, but I get the point anyway. No hypo-Clintos in the God-blessed Texas. Literally, I don't know what they mean. Figuratively, I get it.
I don't either.
They also promoted
Rachel.
Hillary for prison. This was them too. Hillary, stay away from Texas, with a photoshopped image of her with Osama bin Laden. Ultimately, this Russian group on Facebook started to promote an idea that must have seemed like a very satisfying prospect to Moscow if they could ever pull this off, right? Right before the election, this Russian-run Texas Facebook group switched over to this as their theme. Secede if Hillary, meaning if Hillary wins the election, Texas should break off from the United States.
And one of the assumptions underlying all of Rachel Maddow's reporting about negative attitudes toward Hillary Clinton is that they didn't exist in the United States. They had to be imported, and of course, the only place they could come from is Russia. And the idea that there aren't people who hated the Clintons for whatever reasons and for however long, none of that is included in this as possible explanations for where this material came from. It's just obvious, and we all know it. It's from Russia.
So then, a week after that reporting on the Texas group, then it was Daily Beast again, uncovering another one of these fake Russian-run outlets operating on Facebook as if it was an American group. This one was called Being Patriotic. It was, naturally, run by Russian agents.
Prove it.
And they promoted pro-Donald Trump protests in Florida. Florida goes Trump. They promoted pro-Trump rallies in Pennsylvania, including Miners for Trump demonstrations in at least two Pennsylvania cities.
Did anybody show up, Rachel?
They promoted with Hillary Clinton protests at Clinton campaign headquarters in New York. Then a few days after that reporting from the Daily Beast, it was Politico.com, finding Russian-backed Facebook ads that were pro-Trump, also pro-Bernie Sanders, even after Bernie Sanders had dropped out of the race and endorsed Hillary Clinton. And right to the bitter end, they were able to find Facebook ads that were promoting the candidacy of Jill Stein. Quote, vote for Jill Stein. Trust me, it's not a wasted vote. Hashtag grow a spine, vote Jill Stein. Then the day after that Politico story, it was ABC News, finding more Russian content on that secretly Russian-run Facebook group,
Russia, Russia,
borders,
Russia, Russia,
that one that
Russia.
Was trying to gin up the anti-immigrant, anti-Clinton stuff in Idaho. That same group was promoting this image.
Now, this is the ad I called out earlier because it refers to President-elect Donald Trump. So by default, if it ran before the election, they knew something most other people didn't. And it's pretty clear that this was part of the 55% of that lousy $100,000 we're told was spent on Facebook that hit after the election. How do you manipulate an election after it's over?
On Facebook, ahead of the election, Donald Trump as Santa, like if you agree, we are going to say Merry Christmas again. These are Russian agents promoting this. The same Russian agents also pitching.
See, here we hear Russian agents. We've moved from just broad Russians, and I've told you there are over 150 million people in Russia, so that's a huge pool to draw on. But now it's Russian agents, Russian agents. And again, there is no evidence to support that language.
Dora the Explorer as an illegal immigrant. And once again, the English is not awesome here. If you get caught, they'd just send you back in your country. So you can try again. It's almost English.
Right. And fractured English only comes from Russia. Couldn't be France. Couldn't be Germany. Couldn't be somebody here in the United States. Just that's clear.
The idea. Then the day after that report, it was CNN who was able to track geographical targeting for fake Black Lives Matter Facebook content that was actually created by the Russian government.
Evidence, please. Can you prove that, Rachel Maddow? I don't think so.
CNN was able to track that those fake Black Lives Matter messages were targeted specifically to Baltimore and to Ferguson, Missouri, trying to, you know, pour maximum fuel on the fire. The Daily Beast and the New York Times have also both now tracked how Russian agents were running various Facebook groups called United Muslims of America, and another one called LGBT United, and another one called Defend the Second, as in Defend the Second Amendment, and another group called Blacktivist. These are Facebook and Twitter groups all run by Russian agents.
Yep.
All designed to cause anxiety and division. And not incidentally, all designed to portray Hillary Clinton as not just liberal, but dangerously radical. And so all of that reporting has happened over the past month or so, since Facebook finally was dragged kicking and screaming into admitting that, yeah, there was Russian paid content on Facebook trying to affect the election. So in a rush, in this past month, we've had all this good, in-depth, concrete reporting to actually make it nuts and bolts, right? To give us something to look at, give us something to see, so we can understand how Russia operated within our election. Just over the past month, we've had this rush of reporting that makes it not so much an esoteric thing anymore. It means we can see it, right? Now we know this is what Russia did during the election.
We know it, yeah.
This was Russian. They're calling themselves Heart of Texas.
This was Russian, she says. And there is no proof. This is the mind-boggling state of media in the United States today. And I'm really saddened by it. I may be the only voice calling out Rachel Maddow by name, but I'm not alone in skepticism of the Trump-Russia narrative. And Aaron Mate, I don't know his work previously, published a piece October 6th at The Nation magazine's website. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, and the headline is clear. Russiagate is more fiction than fact. And Mate is saying, just almost a year after Election Day, there is still no concrete evidence of the central allegations. There are claims by U.S. intelligence officials that the Russian government hacked emails and used social media to help elect Trump, but there is yet to be any corroboration. And he cites the New York Times, noting the absence of any proof or hard evidence to back up the agency's claims that the Russian government engineered the election attack. The New York Times concluded that the intelligence community's message essentially amounts to trust us. Mate says that remains the case today. Recognizing this absence of evidence, continuing to quote here, helps examine what has been substituted in its place. He cites Shattered, the insider account of the Clinton campaign, reporting that within 24 hours of Clinton's concession speech, top officials gathered to engineer the case that the election wasn't entirely on the up and up. Already, Russian hacking was the centerpiece of the argument. And this dovetails with the elements of state power that oppose Trump's call for improved relations with Moscow and who are willing to deploy a familiar playbook of Cold War fearmongering to block any developments on that front. The multiple investigations and anonymous leaks are also a tool to pacify an erratic president whose anti-interventionist rhetoric, by all indications, a ruse, alarmed foreign policy elites during the campaign. The public is presented with a real-life spy thriller, which for some carries the added appeal of possibly undoing a reviled president and his improbable victory. And that's why I refer to it as a telenovela, as a soap opera. Mate goes on, these imperatives have incentivized a compromised set of journalistic and evidentiary standards. In Russiagate, unverified claims are reported with little to no skepticism. Comporting developments are cherry-picked and overhyped, while countervailing ones are minimized or ignored. And that's what you heard in my commentary, talking back to Rachel Maddow. Once again, quoting The Nation, qualified language, likely, suspected, apparent, appears next to Russians to account for the absence of concrete links. As a result, Russiagate has enlarged into a storm of innuendo that engulfs issues far beyond its original scope. And it's a lengthy piece, but one of the issues he takes on is Facebook's disclosure that fake accounts, quote, likely operated out of Russia, quote, paid $100,000 for 3,000 ads starting in June of 2015. As I do, he notes that 56% were posted after the election and that a $100,000 Facebook ad buy seems unlikely to have had much impact in a $6.8 billion election or compared to the $70 or $80 million that the Trump campaign itself spent on Facebook. The ads are commonly described as Russian disinformation, but in the most extensive reporting on the story to date, the Washington Post adds multiple qualifiers, noting that the ads appear to have come from accounts associated with the Internet Research Agency, which is described as a Kremlin-linked firm. These are weasel words. And I'm proud that Bob Perry at Consortium News is still on the case. His latest is entitled Russiagate Jumps the Shark. And he opens by saying a key distinction between propaganda and journalism is that manipulative propaganda relies on exaggeration and deceit, while honest journalism provides context and perspectives. He says Tuesday the major news outlets were filled with the latest lurid chapter of Russiagate, how Google had detected suspected Russia-linked accounts that bought several thousand dollars worth of ads. The Washington Post ran this item as front page news, headlined, Google finds links to Russian disinformation in its services. And the opening paragraph said, Russian operatives bought ads across several of Google's services without the company's knowledge. The latest evidence that their campaign to influence U.S. voters was as sprawling as it was sophisticated. Wow, says Perry, that sounds serious. But if you read deeply enough into the story, you discover that the facts are a wee bit less dramatic. For example, Google's internal investigation found $4,700 of search ads and display ads that the company believes are Russian-connected, and another $53,000 in ads with political content purchased from Russian internet providers, addresses in Russia, or with rubles. And Perry goes on to say a journalist rather than a propagandist would immediately follow these figures with some context, that Google's net digital ad sales revenue is about $70 billion a year. These tiny ad buys with some alleged connection to Russia, a nation of 144 million people who are not all Vladimir Putin's operatives, are infinitesimal when put into any rational perspective. And as I pointed out with the Trump ad showing him as Santa Claus that was obviously run after the election, Perry notes it doesn't seem to matter that facts don't always fit the desired narrative. And they never explore alternative explanations. That there might not be a sinister Kremlin campaign to poison American politics or to install Trump in the White House. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And today I'm going to single out one individual, Benny Alto, who lives in Oregon. And he just took out his fourth monthly subscription. And it's in honor of his new puppy, a four-month-old called Gus. And Benny already holds monthly subscriptions for Gracie, Peaches, and Roosevelt. And I want you to know, Benny, that Chloe really appreciates this canine support. Now, if you'd like to honor your pet or just make a contribution, take out a subscription, come on over to peterbcollins.com. I could really use your support. All you got to do is click on the menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You get to the sign-up page. You got options. You can get a 24-hour pass for a dollar and listen to my latest in-depth interview. You can get $5 a month, $10, $20, a $50 annual subscription. At the very bottom are instructions on how you can make a one-time contribution of any amount. So please get on it and do what you can to support the work I do here. Now, there is real hacking in the world, and the U.S. is responsible for a lot of it. But a South Korean lawmaker is now giving out details about a hack that occurred at least a year ago, September of 2016, about the time the Russia meddling meme was launched in the American political discussion. And according to a lawmaker named Ri Chul-hee, one of the plans that was hacked by the North Koreans is what's called a decapitation plan. Should war break out, it's the plan to go snuff out the life of Kim Jong-un. And given that this was transferred to North Korea over a year ago, doesn't this offer some explanation as to why Kim has ratcheted up his nuclear and missile development programs and why he doesn't want to be like Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, and he is carving out a confrontational path with the United States. Why? Well, because in the event of war, the agreement with South Korea is that the U.S. would run any military operations, including the decapitation. And so, you may not have any fondness for Kim Jong-un, and I wouldn't try to foist that on you. But we always describe him as this irrational guy who is just trying to tweak the United States. But he views us as a clear and present danger to his continued existence on the planet. And it's another reason why Trump's bullying and threats will only compound the problem. New leak-based reporting by the Washington Post, they say they talked to 18 present or former White House officials, and they are reporting that the White House is like a pressure cooker and that Trump is ready to explode at any moment. The article opens, frustrated by his cabinet, angry that he hasn't received enough credit for his handling of hurricanes, President Trump is now lashing out, rupturing alliances, and imperiling his legislative agenda, numerous White House officials and outside advisors said Monday. Now, nobody in the White House, of course, is willing to be named in this article, and the 18 number, because it's present and former, could mean there's only one guy in the White House or gal who is offering this commentary. But they are hunkered down. They are they're cringing at the way Trump has been tweeting back and forth with Bob Corker. He did it again today. He has a new nickname, Little Bob, L-I-D-D-L-E. The article notes that nobody came to Trump's defense on Monday, no Republican leaders, and that also nobody or few openly sided with Corker either. And that's because people are afraid of Trump. I think of a guy like Rob Portman from Ohio, you know, in Republican terms, he's slightly moderate, but he's up for re-election next year, and he's not going to put himself into the Twitter sites of our dear tweeter. The article continues, Trump in recent days has shown flashes of fury, left his aides, including Chief of Staff John Kelly, scrambling to manage his outbursts. He's been frustrated in particular with Secretary of State Rexon Tillerson, who was reported last week to have earlier called the president a moron. And so we get the image of a White House in deep chaos around this maniac who just bounces from one Fox News report to the next. And what's interesting, if you go to the Washington Post, there's an editorial today, something to the effect of what to do about a president who's out of control. And it's really lame, because it basically raises the issue of impeachment and says, no, we're not going to do that. And it suggests in a kind of fantasy way that elected Republicans on Capitol Hill are suddenly going to move into a nonpartisan anti-Trump mode. I find that bizarre. A bit of a surprise in Barcelona tonight. It actually occurred, you know, I'm speaking to you in the afternoon, but the session was held Tuesday evening in the Parliament of Catalonia, and Carles Puigdemont, who is the leader of the separatist movement there, the independence movement in Catalonia, has surprised us by saying, I'm asking Parliament to suspend the Declaration of Independence so that in the coming weeks we can undertake a dialogue. Now, it's pretty clear that Barcelona is kind of isolated. There is no ally in Europe that said, sure, if you become independent, we'll trade with you, we'll support you. The Spanish government has successfully squelched most available outside support. And so this call for talks might lead to some sort of mediation, but there's no obvious partner or neutral source to undertake this move. And I expect Madrid will conduct business as usual, which is just to ignore this effort to start dialogue and try to push the independence just basically over a cliff. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu announced today approval of an additional 3,736 illegal units in Jewish settlements in occupied West Bank territory. In the communities of Hebron, Migron, and Beit El, which is a settlement on the outskirts of the Palestinian capital, Ramallah. Well, this is just another effort to use the Trump presidency to move forward on efforts that were at least criticized by the Obama administration. And Hanan Ashrawi, member of the executive committee of the PLO, said Israel is bent on entrenching the military occupation and its illegal settlement enterprise, further reaffirming its intentions of displacing Palestine and replacing it with greater Israel. And finally today, there has been a stunning shift in the narrative of the Las Vegas Mandalay Bay shooting incident. The sheriff of Clark County announced today that there is a change in the timeline, which really throws the narrative that has been in place and challenged by many skeptics, including me, for the better part of a week now. And the issue is that the security guard who was outside of the hotel room of Stephen Paddock, well, he took a bullet to the leg when reportedly Paddock shot over 200 rounds through his hotel room door based on the little cameras that he had installed on a room service cart and apparently on the peephole in his hotel room door. Now, the critical change in the timeline is we were previously told that the security guard, whose name is Jesus Campos, took that bullet shortly before the police officers got to the 32nd floor and the shooting by Paddock stopped. But now we are told that Jesus Campos took that bullet and the 200 rounds that were fired into the hallway occurred 6 minutes before Paddock began shooting at the crowd at the Country Music Festival across the street from Mandalay Bay. Now, in the same breath, without a quote, the Guardian article here reports that the sheriff asserted there is no indication anyone other than Paddock fired on the crowd. Now, we know of all the real-time police radio calls where second and third shooters were speculated on. There are pictures that show that more than two windows on the 32nd floor were shattered at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. There are a lot of important questions here, but this shift in the timeline still doesn't address the open question about why it took a reported 72 minutes after the shooting stopped for the cops to blow down the door and enter the hotel room of Stephen Paddock. So I remain unconvinced about the official narrative, which is changing, and I will continue to pursue any kind of authentic challenge to the official story. There's a lot of wild speculation out there on the internet, and some of it may turn out to be true. Was Paddock working for the FBI? Was this a failed effort at a new fast and furious gun sting operation? Well, these questions circulate and have credibility, or at least some currency, because our government has lied to us in the past, and they're operating in a cover-up manner, in this case right now. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's free, and it's available on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.